Argo Bank, N.A.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to meet the new business columnist for the Tampa Bay Times. And then later on, we're going to open up the phone lines and talk about some of the big issues that are going on around the country. But first, our first guest is Graham Brink, who's just been named the business columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. Graham is a graduate of Queen's University and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He started the Times in 1997 as an intern. He worked as a reporter in Hernando, Hillsborough, Pasco, and Pinellas counties. Brink joined the editing ranks in 2007 as an assistant metro editor, and he became a business editor a year later and went on to edit a series of stories on nuclear power plants that won the Gerald Loeb Award, one of the highest honors in business reporting. Brink was promoted to the Metro editor in 2014 and named assistant managing editor of Metro and Business in 2016. In his new role, Brink will replace Robert Trigault, who retired last year. And Graham Brink, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here. Thanks for coming. Okay. Thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
Thanks. Congratulations on the new job. What does a business columnist do?
Well, this business columnist is going to write columns about all kinds of different things happening here in the Tampa Bay area and in Florida. Everything from the economic impact of companies moving in to if there's some government interaction with some of our companies to what's going on at the port. Some of our sports teams have an economic impact, all kinds of stories like that, but also some consumer issues. I've already written a column about the Takata airbag situation where people were having trouble getting their faulty airbags replaced. It's a whole variety of stories.
So the business section is mainly about business, but there's no labor reporter. Let me ask you, why aren't there labor reporters at newspapers?
Well, I'd say in a way we're all kind of labor reporters. We cover obviously the unemployment rate and the job numbers that come out each month, both from a national standpoint and here in Florida. And then we often take those numbers and depending on our various beats and the various things that we cover, we'll dig a little deeper into, say, the construction figures or the figures coming out of professional and business services or hospitality, since our state is very tourism-driven. And we'll write stories and columns about those various issues. I mean, we, for instance, have a retail reporter. She will sometimes look into those numbers herself and figure out what's going on in the retail sector. We have reporters that take a look at the port and the airport and things like that. So they'll sometimes look into numbers that are or labor figures that are related to those sectors as well.
So, Graham, how is the local economy? How would you describe its status right now as you take on this job as business columnist?
It's good, but it could improve. Obviously, if anybody's been around for at least 10 or 12 years, they in this area, they went through a terrible recession where unemployment got above 10%. Real estate values were more or less cut in half. We couldn't create jobs nearly as quickly as people needed them. And so compared to that, we're looking really solid. Real estate prices are back up. Unemployment in the state is about 3.9%. Locally, depending on which county you're in, it's even lower than that. Basically, most people who can find a job or want a job, I should say, have been able to find one. Now, some of the things that are lagging, wage growth. We're not paying people as much as many people would like to be paid. That wage growth has not gone up with the job growth. This is one of the things we've struggled with in our area and in Florida in general as well for years, is increasing pay, in part because we are somewhat driven by tourism and service sector jobs, which generally don't pay as well as, say, jobs in the professional and business services sector or even education and health services. So there's still some work to be done, but things are certainly better than they were just a few years ago.
Because I think, some cities like Seattle and San Francisco and Denver and obviously Boston and New York and Washington, D.C., Their middle class is growing, I think it's fair to say, at a slightly faster rate than ours did, in part because you said that we rely on service industry, so in the tourism industry. So how do we get out of that so that, can you get out of that by paying service industry workers better pay, or do you have to go away from the service industry and get into some other kind of industry in order to grow the middle class?
Well, I wouldn't put it as getting away from the service industry. That's an important industry. There's lots of people that work in that industry. Some of those jobs do pay well. What it is I think, growing some of the other sectors as much as we can, attracting companies that pay better because they're in the technology world, or they're in the higher end of the healthcare world, or the more professional companies. We're always looking for Fortune 500 companies to move here, or startups to grow to the point where they're employing hundreds, if not thousands, of people. We need to grow some of those homegrown companies as well as we can, but also continue to attract outside businesses to either relocate here or start up here.
So I want to ask you about millennials. I often hear that young people don't find enough to do here in the Tampa Bay area in terms of quality jobs, and that many young people move from here to those cities that I just mentioned, places like Seattle and Denver and San Francisco and New York and Washington, D.C. and Boston, Minneapolis, where there seems to be a more welcoming area for millennials. Is that your sense, that millennials are not attracted to live here? And if so, what could be done to attract millennials to live here?
I think there's some of that going on. I think there's always going to be a draw to some of the big cities like New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago, L.A., cities like that. And Seattle, to a certain extent, just because there's so many tech companies there. And so there's going to be a draw there. I think a few of the things we can do are to make sure that the millennials are as well educated as we can make them. One of the things that constantly comes out in report after report about the Tampa Bay area is that we don't have as educated as a community as some of the cities you just mentioned. We're often near the bottom in terms of things like high school graduation rate. We're way below places like, say, Austin and Dallas, Fort Worth. When it comes to advanced degrees, we're usually near the bottom as well, like way below places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Portland, Denver, Charlotte, Baltimore, cities like that often have more people with either some college or college degree. And so the better educated we are as a community, the more likely we are going to be able to keep some of those millennials, in part because more people will start up companies that stick, that actually some of these millennials will want to work for. I'm not too concerned about millennials leaving in large numbers, but I mean, it is something we should keep our eye on, because we've done a pretty good job over the years of dissuading people of the reputation that we have here as being just the place to retire. Obviously, we have a much more vibrant business community now, and I think we've done a good job of promoting that to states and cities outside of the Florida area.
Well, we're talking with Graham Brink, who's been named the business columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. Graham, can you give us any insight about Mosaic? Mosaic is moving its headquarters here. I don't think they've announced where they're moving in the Tampa Bay area, but do you have any inside information about Mosaic, mainly a giant phosphate company, but they have other interests too. Why did they decide to move here, and where are they moving to?
Yeah, sure, you're right. Mosaic is one of the largest producers of phosphate and potash, and they also have a sophisticated distribution network, so they can move all that stuff all over the world. They have a very large presence in Florida already, more than 3,000 employees, more than 3,000 contractors, mostly in sort of eastern Hillsborough, Polk, Highlands, DeSoto, those counties, big mining operations. They have not said exactly where they're going to move their headquarters to. They're moving from Plymouth, Minnesota, to somewhere in Hillsborough County. That may be in downtown Tampa, but it may be closer to their operations in eastern Hillsborough. They haven't said exactly when either. They're moving for a few reasons. One, they think they'll have basically their better tax situation here, so they'll be able to keep more of their own money. They also have a large presence in South America that they've been growing over the last few years, and so they want to be closer to their holdings in places like Brazil and Peru. It's a little easier for them to get there from here, keep an eye on those things. But they also very much like Florida's business climate, and they are obviously now much closer to their Florida operations, which are massive.
So why do companies relocate? I mean, we talked about education among millennials, but what attracts, like, you know, is it taxes? You mentioned taxes. Is it education? Is it climate, transportation, skilled workers, research universities? What attracts a company to move to a location?
Well, I think you just hit on several of them, but it's pretty rare for a Fortune 500 company to move its headquarters. But just in general, companies, what companies are looking for are an educated workforce, depending on the type of company they have, and then that depends on the type of education they want. If it's a technology company, they want to make sure there's a bunch of tech-savvy people in the community. If they're a healthcare company, they're looking for a different type of worker. But education, obviously, is very important to most companies. They're looking for a consistent and low tax structure, which Florida often provides, depending on the type of company. Transportation comes up quite a bit, and that's an area that we lag in some ways. And, you know, if you compare us to other communities, we're sort of middle of the road when it comes to commuting times. I know sometimes if you're sitting in the Howard Franklin at, 3 or 4:30 on a Thursday afternoon, you might think it's the worst traffic in the world. But we're often middle of the road, though we could improve that. It's one thing that comes up in a lot of the business surveys is that more companies might move here if transportation was a little bit better. Having USF, University of South Florida, right there in Tampa, and a campus in St. Petersburg as well, that helps draw companies if they're looking for particular education skills or a partnership with a university. That can help. Having a port, a very active port right here, can be helpful too, depending if you're in the shipping or manufacturing business. So there's a lot of things that go into it, but I would say that the two things that we generally lag on that come up fairly consistently are education and transportation.
Well, we're talking with Graham Brink, who's been named the business columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. So, Graham, do companies like send you, are you flooded with press releases and ideas for stories and columns? Is that what happens when you become the business columnist at the Tampa Bay Times?
A fair amount. My email gets pretty crowded. I obviously can't get to I look at most of them, but I can't, you know, I'm not going to write about 98% of them probably, just because there's too many of them. I try to stick with the ones that are more Tampa Bay focused. We obviously come up with our own ideas as well, but since my new job was announced, and we ran a small story in the paper about it. A lot of people have reached out.
What do you think is the most interesting business that exists here that gets almost no press? I mean, we hear about the big companies like Mosaic, right? Are there startups here that you've found? I know it's early in your career as a business columnist, but are there unusual things that are going on here that you think might have a huge impact down the road?
Sure, and we really are a community of more sort of small and mid-sized businesses. As you say, we've got some big ones, Raymond James, Bloomin' Brands, Tech Data, Jabil. We certainly have some big ones, but we really are a community of smaller, mid-sized companies. I mean, some of these are fairly well-known, but most of your listeners probably haven't heard of, say, a company called KnowBe4. It's a cybersecurity awareness training startup. It's run by a serial entrepreneur. It's apparently doing gangbusters. It helps companies not get hacked, essentially, from the outside. There's Black & Denim Apparel, that is obviously a clothing company that's a startup here locally. There's a company called Beneficial Blends, which is a coconut oil products company that made the Inc. 5000. So there's quite a few companies like that. There's a bigger one called Power Design, which is an electrical contractor, started off with a handful of employees, now has, I think, more than 600 employees in the Tampa Bay area and somewhere near 2,000 nationally. That it also is doing very well, getting a lot of contracts, obviously is helped by the booming construction industry. So there's a lot of those around here, and some of them will grow even bigger. Some of them will fail, and that's part of what happens. You have a lot of startups, you're going to have a lot of failure rate, but then you end up creating the next, the next Raymond James or the next Outback Steakhouse or companies like that that end up growing into huge national brands.
You know, when we talk about startups, for the last couple of years, the Times and other newspapers have been reporting about the controversy involving the spending of money from Enterprise Florida, which basically is a subsidy to companies, mostly big companies, that come here to Florida. And I think the small businesses feel left out, that you know, you look at, you read the paper every day and you see these big companies getting some sort of incentives. And this goes back decades to, you know, for the last 20 or 25 years, we've been reading about these incentives to bring companies here. Do we, you know, is it a fair playing field for small businesses and for large businesses when it comes to incentives from the state of Florida?
Yeah, incentives have become quite controversial. Even the Speaker of the House, Richard Corcoran, was not really in favor of many of these incentive programs. The governor, Governor Scott, obviously was very much in favor of it. It's one of his main pushes in his jobs program. I would say that the incentives can come in many forms and can end up attracting many different companies, not just big ones. But what I would say, one thing we hear about a lot here, I hear about it, is smaller companies that start here. So they're not moving. It's not an incentive to move them from New York or New Jersey or Ohio. It's they're already here, and they don't often get those incentives because they're already here. There's nothing. There's no reason to move them. That they would like a little bit more support, a little less focus on these companies that are moving from someplace else, and a little more support for their own startup. That's something we hear quite a bit.
You know, I'm wondering about the price of housing. I mean, we hear horror stories about places like San Francisco that the workforce that does, maybe restaurant work or other kinds of service work can't find housing in the city of San Francisco because it's so expensive. We heard the results of the hurricane that a lot of the workforce housing was destroyed during Hurricane Irma in the Keys, in the Florida Keys. I'm wondering, what's your sense about housing affordability here in the Tampa Bay area? Are we rising to those kind of levels where workers are being priced out of the central parts of cities like St. Petersburg and Tampa and Sarasota?
Yeah, so you've hit on a really good issue because most people know, if they've been living here for a while, that housing prices have been going up. We're not quite back to where we were in 2006 in terms of median price, but generally, you know, the place is moving along well in terms of price growth on the home side. What's lagging is what I brought up before, is wages. And so generally, a rule of thumb is you buy a house three times the amount of what you earn in a year. So if you're earning $50,000 or $60,000, you can buy a $180,000 house. Trouble is now the median price of a house around here for a new one is up above $200,000, closer to $250,000. And so wages aren't keeping up. And so even in a place like San Francisco, wages are so much higher that the affordability index can actually be in San Francisco's favor. Now, if you're a service worker in San Francisco, I feel pretty bad for you trying to buy an $800,000 house. But here, our wages are lower all around. And so there's sort of two factors that go into affordability. It's not just the price of the house. It's how much money everyone's making and whether they can afford those houses. And so we could be seeing people getting stretched much thinner with the rising house prices and the wages not keeping up. And as you pointed out, on the people who are just starting out in their career or in a lower paying service sector, housing can become even less affordable. Our rents in this area are higher than you would expect, given how much we pay or how much our wages are, our average wages are here. And so that's becoming a bit of an affordability issue all around in this area.
So I wonder if other cities have dealt with this issue. I mean, if any other cities have found a good solution to the rising cost of housing. I think obviously raising the wages, that's a great idea. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but have other cities had any other kinds of programs that seem to work for the workforce?
There's been a few, and we have some of these around here as well. Sometimes there are programs that target teachers and police officers and firefighters so that they can live in the community that they are serving if house prices are higher than they can afford. We have some of that here. Just simply providing incentives for builders to build more affordable housing can help. That's worked in other areas. That can be controversial. We have some of those here as well. And so they're not building just $2,000 a month apartments. They build some that are more in the $700, $800 range that can help a lot of people out. So sometimes, local and regional and state governments can come in and say, look, we'll give you an incentive to build a building that can house people that are sort of in the lower half in terms of wages, as opposed to always trying to build the high-end condos, the high-end houses, and the high-end apartment building.
Graham, why did you want to go into business reporting? Why does that excite you?
Because I think business, everything revolves around business. I think there's so many good stories. I know some people, when they think of the economy or finance, maybe their eyes glaze over a little bit, but it really helps explain how we live, what's happening in our community. And they don't all have to be number stories or even directly involved in the macro economy. I mean, they can be cool stories about some 23-year-old woman who's just out of college who started some business that's taking off. It can be the retiree who is mentoring younger entrepreneurs. It's a great opportunity to explain and help people understand the community they're living in and why certain things are happening the way they're happening.
What's the next column we're going to see from you in the Times?
I think one just went up, and it'll be in tomorrow's paper. It just went up on the web, and it'll be in tomorrow's paper about the ratio between what CEOs are paid and what their median worker is paid. This is a new disclosure that most large publicly traded companies have to include in their financial statements. And so most of them have come out just this year. There's a few that haven't yet, but it shows exactly that. They've had to determine what their median worker gets paid. Now, for years, they've had to disclose what their CEO gets paid, but this provides a interesting look at the difference between the two. Most of the CEOs of large companies are making more than a million, if not millions of dollars, and the median workers generally aren't making that much.
And it's far different here in the U.S. than it is in places like Japan and Western Europe.
Oh, yeah. Our CEO structure, pay structure is on the high end in general. There are some exceptions to that. We have some local exceptions to that. One could argue that Publix pays its CEO less than a CEO of a company of equivalent size would make. We have some of those. But I'll point out Larry Page, the CEO of Google, paid himself $1 last year. Some of them are much lower paid. But generally around here in the United States, we pay our CEOs more than what equivalent CEOs in other countries get paid.
Graham, if people want to send you suggestions for columns or stories, can they send them to you?
Sure. They can send them to me at gbrink@tampabay.com, or they can follow me at Graham Brink. It's quite simple.
All right. Well, Graham Brink, congratulations on the new job.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Anytime.
That's Graham Brink, who has just been named the business columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, in a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. I want to get your take on something that's playing out in Washington, and I'm going to play some sound from two different people as we do this. Reading from the Associated Press from this morning, ratcheting up pressure on the Russia investigation, the Trump White House has announced that top FBI and Justice Department officials have agreed to meet with congressional leaders and review highly classified information the lawmakers have been seeking on the handling of the probe. The agreement follows President Trump's extraordinary demand that the Department of Justice investigate whether the FBI infiltrated his campaign. The Trump administration is essentially asking to see evidence that the Trump campaign colluded with foreign powers, even as the investigation continues. Well, we're going to get two different perspectives on that right now and then open up the phone lines. We're going to hear Adam Schiff, who is a congressman from California. He was asked about this, about sharing this information last night on CNN. And here is a part of his interview with Wolf Blitzer. Let's listen in on this.
California Congressman Adam Schiff. He's the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thanks very much for joining us. So what do you think about this demand from the president yesterday? I hereby demand that they look into this to try to find out if this informant, or what he called a spy for all practical purposes, was authorized to go ahead and establish these contacts with Trump campaign officials.
Well, I think second to the firing of Comey, this is the most direct assault on the independence of the Justice Department, the most direct effort to interfere with this investigation of the Trump campaign. It's deeply disturbing. Obviously, it puts the Justice Department in a very difficult position. Normally, you would expect if the Congress were trying to erode the department's independence or compromise an investigation, that the president would protect the department. And conversely, if the president were trying to do it, the Congress would protect the department. But here we have a weak speaker. We have members of Congress that are only too happy to be complicit with the president in beating down the independence of the Justice Department. And this is a major threat to the rule of law.
Because he said in his tweet yesterday, and I'll read it again, I hereby demand, and will do so officially tomorrow, that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI, DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes, and if any such demands or requests were made by people within the Obama administration. We now know that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, has ordered that the Inspector General take a look at this.
Yes, and you know, I think they're trying to figure out how do they skin this cat at the Justice Department. How do they not be, on the one hand, insubordinate to a order of the president, but on the other hand, make sure that they don't erode the independence of the Justice Department. So they've kicked it to the Inspector General. I have to say, I am concerned with some of the comments of the Deputy Attorney General suggesting, well, we'll look in to find out whether there's any legitimate concern about a politically embedded spy. They know that's nonsense, and I hate to see them say anything to give it credence.
Tell us why it's nonsense.
Well, because it simply didn't happen. And when you hear reports, was just related, that there is concern within the White House about this, there's not concern within the White House about this. There is a sense of opportunity. Let's exploit anything, any doubt we can create. This is a defense strategy. Put the government on trial. When the evidence looks increasingly incriminating of your client, in this case the president, put the investigators on trial. And that's all they're trying to do here. And the question is, will the Congress go along with it? And sadly, you have a few members of Congress who are actively helping the president in this. And then the rest, in terms of the governing party, are remaining silent.
Do you have confidence in the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, who's now been charged with looking into this?
Well, he has a good reputation. I have to say, though, I'm concerned with one of the decisions that may have come out of his office already, and that is there was a decision to accelerate the investigation into Andrew McCabe so that he could be fired.
The deputy director of the FBI.
Yes, so that he could be fired before his pension vested. Now, there's nothing irregular with his being a part of that broad investigation, but it is very unusual to say of this broad investigation, we're going to pick this one piece, this one individual, and we're going to put it on a fast track so he can be fired before his pension. And the fact that the president was openly calling for him to be fired before he got his pension looks like it had its intended effect. And if that's the case, then the independence of the Inspector General is at risk. And so there are lots of concerns, both in terms of the department, its Inspector General, but more broadly, we see a wholesale assault on the rule of law and the ability of...
Well, that was Adam Schiff last night, Congressman from California, Democrat, talking about the request from the Trump administration to review highly classified information that the Trump administration and its allies in Congress have been seeking on the handling of the Russia probe, specifically looking into the question of whether or not the FBI infiltrated the Trump campaign in 2016. Well, do you think that the FBI infiltrated the Trump campaign in 2016? You heard that interview with Adam Schiff there. What do you think? 813-239-9663. I'm going to read from... And I've lost it temporarily, so I'm going to bring it up in a second. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. I'm going to talk about the informant in just a second. Let's see if I can bring this back up from The Intercept, which reported the informant's name over the weekend. I'll just read the beginning of the story. This is something that so far I think the mainstream media has not been reporting. But, okay, so who was this person who allegedly spied on the campaign, on the Trump campaign in 1980? And the informant has this story that came out on Saturday. The headline is, the FBI informant who monitored the Trump campaign, Stefan Helper, that's his name, oversaw a CIA spying operation in the 1980 presidential campaign. And The Intercept, I'll just read one paragraph. The Intercept reports that four decades ago, this guy Helper was responsible for a long-forgotten spying scandal involving the 1980 election, in which the Reagan campaign, using CIA officials managed by Helper, reportedly under the direction of former CIA director and then vice presidential candidate George H.W. Bush, got caught running a spying operation from inside the Carter administration. The plot involved CIA operatives passing classified information about Carter's foreign policy to Reagan campaign officials in order to ensure the Reagan campaign knew of any foreign policy decisions that Carter was considering. And The Intercept goes on to say that over the past several weeks, House Republicans have been claiming that the FBI during the 2016 election used an operative to spy on the Trump campaign, and they triggered outrage within the FBI by trying to learn his identity. And the president, of course, joining the fray, saying last Friday that reports are there was indeed at least one FBI representative implanted for political purposes into my campaign for president, Trump tweeted, adding that it took place very early on and long before the phony Russia hoax became a hot fake news story. Trump goes on to say, if true, all-time biggest political scandal. Now, there are reports out there that Halperin did have meetings with several officials in the Trump campaign, but as for monitoring or being implanted inside the campaign, no reports have surfaced so far. So what do you think? 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's listen to one soundbite, one more bit of sound from this morning on MSNBC, where a Louisiana senator, John Kennedy, was asked about whether or not it's right for the Trump administration to review the highly classified information about the investigation into the Trump campaign. And here's what John Kennedy said this morning on MSNBC. And let's listen to this and get your take. 813-239-9663.
The president of the United States, the guy that runs the executive branch, is striking out against Robert Mueller, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and other intel agencies.
I'm concerned if the president tries to influence an investigation. Now, as long as he offers his opinion about an investigation, he's entitled to do that, just as you are, just as I am. There's no doubt in my mind that the Russians did interfere in the 2016 election. Now, did they determine the outcome of the election? You know, I don't know how anybody can draw that conclusion, even with the facts. People have a multitude of reasons for voting the way they do. All I'm saying is that all we have is speculation. Sometimes it's rational speculation, but speculation. It's rumor. It's innuendo. And I want to see the facts. If somebody did something wrong, if the chips fall where they may.
Right.
But the American people are smart enough to figure it out. But we got to have a report. And I trust the FBI to give us a report, and I trust the Inspector General to give us a report. And let's get the facts. And if somebody deserves to be punished, let's punish the hell out of them and move on.
I totally agree with you. And I don't want to haggle. This is the last question I'll ask regarding this investigation. But you said you're concerned if the president tries to influence the investigation, or if anybody tries to influence the investigation.
Yes.
He is the president of the United States. He has appointed these people in the Justice Department. He has appointed the director of the FBI. He can fire all these people, saying, and so it seems to me, by very nature of a president striking out, attacking an investigation, attacking the FBI, attacking the Justice Department, would be like you or me walking into our offices and attacking people inside of our offices. By the very nature of the positions we hold and the very nature of the position the president of the United States holds, that would be him trying to influence the investigation, correct?
Well, it comes down to character, Joe. If we have people in upper echelon of the FBI or Justice Department that can't stand up.
I completely agree with you, but I'm not trying to get into their heads. I'm just trying to get to the point on whether Donald Trump is trying to investigate the investigation by his very actions, by the words.
I don't know. I mean, and really, nobody else does. You can draw conclusions from the objective evidence. No.
And this is why the American people don't know what's going on.
It's pretty
because there's no answer.
It's pretty objective evidence, though, is it not, Willie?
Senator, it's Willie Geist. You said a minute ago, echoing something that the vice president said last week, that you wish Mueller would, quote, wrap it up. I wonder why there's this urgency to get it over with. You're a practicing attorney for a long time. Shouldn't the time for it to wrap up be when the investigation is complete, when all the evidence has been gathered, and then the special counsel can give us his report? Why this rush to get it over with now?
Well, I don't think we're rushing. I mean, it's been a year.
But you don't know where the investigation stands, so why would you say right here and now that it's time to wrap it up without knowing what's happening in the investigation?
This is why I say that. Russian interference, and they did try to interfere in our 2016 elections, is an important issue. But we've got a lot of other important issues. And this issue, guy, just sucks all the oxygen out of the room. I mean, on some days, that's all anybody wants to talk about. In the media and outside of the media. And all I'm saying is my personal preference. I'm not trying to tell Mr. Mueller what to do. I don't have the authority anyway. I'm not trying to interfere in his investigation. I don't want to end his investigation. I would just ask respectfully if he can, along with the Inspector General, to try to wrap it up. Now, in terms of the president trying to influence the investigation, look, the president tweets a lot. We know that.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of it. If he asked me my advice, I would tell him that I'd try to convince him that tweeting less would not cause brain damage. You don't have to tweet every day, but he likes to tweet, and that's his style, and that's his prerogative, and it's not my style, but it's his.
But would you agree, Senator, that the fact that a lot of people are talking about Bob Mueller's investigation, the fact that it may be a distraction to the president, is not a reason to, quote, wrap it up?
Sure, that not alone, no. But I think a year's a long time, and I will be. I mean, I confess, I'm guilty. I'll be glad when this is all over with. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of other, not more, but a lot of other important issues. And there are some days, Willie, up here where there's no oxygen left in the room. It's just all goes to the Russian.
But you agree, Senator, it's important to find out how and why Russia did meddle, as you said they did it, how and why they meddled in the 2016 election. So wouldn't you want that investigation to play out however long it takes?
Yes, I do. And we know they tried to meddle. We know one of the ways they did it was through social media platforms. Look, if I were king for a day, and I'm not and don't aspire to be, I would hit Putin so hard with sanctions, he'd cough up bones. I'd just shut him down. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, so Senator, we want to make sure that a Republican, a good Republican like yourself, come on our show. And I think they're going to have to talk about Donald Trump and Robert Mueller and Russia the whole time.
Oh, look. Watch the show all the time. I enjoy it.
You know, it's like Jeb Bush said, we get a seal. It's like 3 hours of just beating the same seal over and over again. That's what Jeb said about our show. So what we want to do here is, because you are correct, there's a lot more stuff going on out there than Donald Trump, his tweets, the Justice Department. You know, that's all extraordinarily important. What issue for you right now is in the front of your mind right now as something that you think the American people need to focus on?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. North Korea, I guess, would be the first.
So let's talk about that.
Well, that's a part of an interview that John Kennedy, the Republican senator from Louisiana, did this morning on MSNBC, and you heard him say that it is time to wrap up the Mueller investigation. He says a year is a long time. He says there's no oxygen left in the room. And we also heard Adam Schiff talk a little bit about call for an investigation into the alleged spy or informant who infiltrated the Trump campaign. And Schiff saying that it was an assault on the independence of the Justice Department. It simply didn't happen. Schiff saying that this is trying to put the investigators on trial. And the governing party, including what he called the weak Speaker of the House is just silent on the issue. So my question is to whether or not there was an informant in the Trump campaign. Should President Trump and his allies get access to the current information about that potential informant? We heard The Intercept, they named somebody that they claimed was the informant. There are other people who say that somebody else was the informant. And whether or not somebody actually infiltrated the campaign or just conducted a Q&A on the sidelines and asked about the campaign, that seems to be one of the questions. Was there an actual mole inside the campaign? So far, nobody's reported the name of that person. But what's your take on this? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Peter, who's in Tampa, who wants to talk about FBI spying. Peter, what would you like to say?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. A couple of things. One, the informant has already been named by three or four newspapers.
Yeah, and
Washington Post named him yesterday.
Yeah, and I just read the Intercept's report, which came out Saturday, so they were the first
one. Yeah, but you just said that it was like one publication. The Washington Post has already named him as well.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say the first one that reported it. But go ahead. Go ahead, Peter.
Right, so it's Halpert, and he did engage in spying in the 80s, political spying, okay?
Yeah, I read
and
that.
So there's
yeah.
every reason to believe that he's engaged in it again, and before I even go on, I want to make it clear, my politics are the left. I supported Bernie Sanders in the last election, and I think one of the things that is getting people confused here is they think that, well, if something is anti-Trump, it must be good. But actually, I believe that all that's going on here is a kind of hatchet job, on the president, well, on Trump, by elements within the military intelligence apparatus that are opposed to him, elements that are aligned with the DNC. So you don't have to be aligned with Trump to see that there's something problematic about what's going on here.
The military intelligence apparatus just got an $80 billion boost in the Pentagon budget. Why would they be opposed to Trump?
With anything, though.
All right, Peter, so the military intelligence apparatus just got an $80 billion boost in the Pentagon budget that President Trump called for. Why would they be opposed to President Trump?
Anything.
What?
They were
going
to get that no matter what. They want him to be aligned with them on Russia and aligned with them on Syria. The reason they didn't like him was both because of his instability, psychological, emotional, whatever, but also because he wanted to make nice with Russia. They didn't want to make nice with Russia. They wanted to be adversarial with respect to Russia, particularly in Syria. So they're basically trying to destabilize his administration. And I think it's fairly obvious at this point that the Mueller investigation is absolutely a fishing expedition. Like, it's so obvious that there was, I mean, I don't think there's really any evidence of any Russian collusion whatsoever. They're just looking for anything they can find on Trump to use against Trump,
and you don't think that the Russians were actively involved in spreading misinformation during the 2016 campaign?
Not the Kremlin. You mean the $100,000 of advertising was purchased on Facebook?
I'm talking about the 3,000 websites that were put out there.
By the Kremlin? Is there any link to the Kremlin? No, none.
Well, who paid for it?
Russian business people.
So is there a connection between Russian business people and the Kremlin?
There's no demonstrated one.
Okay, so Russian business people are completely separate from the Kremlin.
Of course they are.
All right, Peter, I'm going to have an interview tomorrow about that very topic, I hope. All right, just use the F word. Peter, don't do that. You could jeopardize their license. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to John in Tampa. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Rob. I promise not to curse like that.
Thank you. That was terrible.
Thank God.
That was terrible.
Sorry. On his behalf, I'm sorry for you. Anyway, playing to your first guest a little bit, I don't know if he was the writer of this article or not, but and I know you want some response on the national issues, but I'll give you a quick one on the local, is that Times reported that Publix is making massive donations to Republican candidates.
Yeah, we talked about it on my TV show on Friday, and I played the sound back yesterday. The Times has been reporting that. Sarah D. Natale has a story in the Times today on page 1B about it, too.
I'll check it out, yeah.
And, here's the question. John, here's the question. Are you boycotting Publix because of this?
I am. In fact, I am sending them almost daily emails on their contact number on the internet, listing what I am spending in groceries elsewhere. And I was a meticulous, I was a Publix kind of person. I mean, they have two stores within three blocks of me, and I never went anywhere else besides Publix, and I am now. And so far, it's over $300. I refuse to go there ever again. And not to mention that I read a little deeper. Once I started to research that issue, I read a little deeper, and they have been against lesbian and gay and bisexual, transgender, and questioning issues for many, many years. I never knew that either. And that's an issue close to my heart. So I just cannot bring myself to walk in there anymore and spend any money. And I hate to say it because it's clean, it's good, the prices are not that bad, it's pleasant, but I just will not, I cannot go in there anymore. I mean,
John, when Publix says, look, you know, we don't support the NRA, we're just supporting our hometown, or at least the Polk County candidate, and Publix is based in Polk County, we're supporting Adam Putnam, who's from Polk County. That's why we're doing it. That's why the family and the business are giving $670,000 to his campaign. What do you say?
Yeah, well, they could have given it to the police beneficial organization or food kitchens or any homeless people. They could have given it to any number of neutral organizations. And I'm sorry, I can't wait to vote again. And I mean, you're talking about never ever having legalized pot in Florida, abortion rights, women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, the Republicans in Florida are just dragging our state down, and it's got to stop. And I don't know, I just can't bring myself to go into a Publix again until they change their minds. I understand there's going to be, I'm going to have to read more, but I understand I'm not the only one. there's a boycott.
Sarah Di Natale reports in the Tampa Bay Times today that a handful of state activist groups have gone on social media urging shoppers to boycott Publix this Memorial Day weekend. So that's
okay.
There are
a lot of great, I can tell your listeners, there's a lot of great places to go, and I'm discovering a lot of interesting places to shop. And good luck to everybody, and thank you, Rob.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Let's go to George in Lakeland, and you can call us, too, at 813-239-9663. George, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, but a quick question. How's Mark doing?
I have not talked to him. I talked to him 2 weeks ago, and I haven't talked to him since, so I'm going to find out. He's still recuperating. He's still recuperating. I know a lot of people are sending in cards and letters to wish him a speedy recovery, and last time I talked to him, he's looking forward to coming back.
All right, great, great. Well, that guy, Peter, I mean, he reminds me of the racist New York attorney, lawyer Aaron Schlossberg. Same attitude. But on the Trump thing, you know, the investigation is going to take a while. It's taken longer than we expect because there's so much into it. There's so many, you know, it's a web of lies. It's a web of intrigue. I mean, remember, Trump's been involved with the Russians since the 90s, and we all knew this, but we still voted for him. So it's gonna take forever. And yeah, if you're being investigated, you can't tell the investigators to wrap it up. I mean,
what do you make of the Trump administration saying we want to see this highly classified information about the handling of the probe? They want us to find out more about this alleged infiltration. Should they be able to see the evidence?
No, they're being investigated. I mean, they're going to get his tax returns. They probably did already. I mean, everything that Trump tried to hide is going to. They're digging in and digging deep. I mean, Sean Hannity's involved. Rudy Giuliani's involved. All these New York guys are involved, and they're not liking it. And they're going to go down with Trump. I mean, they're going to stick it out until the very end, but they're all going down. But I think it's going to work out for the 2020 election. You know, that's probably when it's going to probably start wrapping up. And that'll be, you know, fuel for us to vote against Trump.
All right, George, thanks a lot.
All righty.
All right, great to hear from you. Peter writes this regarding the business section of the Times. He says, we want stories about democracy in the workplace. We want labor to be prioritized over capital, writes Peter. And Adam writes this regarding the Trump administration. He says, they can't get their story straight. Sam Clovis directly contradicted Trump when he said that there was not an informant in the campaign and that person had nothing to do with the campaign. It was a British professor who talked to the Trump campaign associates, Clovis being one of them, Clovis being a part of the Trump campaign. And then 813 writes this, I watched The Grapes of Wrath last night and nothing has changed. That's actually from Rob in Tampa. That is a great movie. And the soliloquy by Henry Fonda at the end of that is just incredible. Let's go to Nate in Tampa. Hey, Nate, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, a guy who called earlier was saying that politics was somewhat toward the left or in the middle. It's so weird to me because when they were investigating Clinton, that took over 1,000 days. When they was investigating Ronald Reagan and one of his people, that took over 1,200 days. This whole thing about this is going on too long, all it is just an attempt to mess with this investigation. And another thing is, they're never going to be able to see that information because if they do, I'm pretty sure the Justice Department will sue them. Or they are freedom liberty groups around the country that could sue them all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court would never allow the Trump administration to say, we got a right to see classified information about information that's being threaded against us. Like, it's kind of pointless to have an investigation if you let the people who get investigated see information. Like, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, if you're the subject of an investigation, you don't get to ask the prosecutors to see the material of the investigation before you have a trial. I mean, then you get discovery and all that, but during the investigation, you don't get to look at the evidence if you're the subject of investigation.
You don't. And what's scary is that my uncle has been a detective at the police, Tampa Police Department for going on 25 years. And it's crazy. I was talking to him last night, and he looked at me and he was like, this is one of the scariest moments right now that I have ever seen. He's saying, because everybody's playing with this. He said, but this man is trying to reorganize how law enforcement works to the highest level. And if they don't stop him, once the overreach goes and you allow it, there's no way to rein it in.
All right. Nate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. 813-239-9663. Sid writes this, did you see the new Adam Putnam ad? Sid writes, it's hideous during the second intermission of the Lightning game last night. I did see the new Adam Putnam ad. I don't know if it's this one, but I saw the second ad where he continues to say that he's campaigning against liberal elites. And I'm wondering, if you happen to be liberal, do you feel like you're part of an elite? Are you... do you have a chauffeur taking you to work every day? Are you paid a lot of money? Do you live in a mansion if you're a liberal? 813-239-9663. Let's go to Danny, who's in Tampa. Hey, Danny, you're on.
Hey, Rob. Real quickly, my sister talked to Mark this weekend, and he'll be home Thursday.
Oh, good.
Yes, and he wants to come over Memorial Day. I don't know how he will be feeling, but we're hoping that he will. So that's the good news, that he's
getting
better.
Great news, yeah.
Fantastic. I disagree with Peter, obviously. I agree with John Dean. This is the biggest Nixonian move that he's made yet. And what Nixon used to do in private, he's doing in public and getting away with it almost every week. And then the second meeting that they had with Eric Prince and then the other guy, the Arab person, I forget his name right now. Yeah, that was definitely looked like that was, and then the third party, and there was Stephen Miller. That looked like that was that right there looks like collusion to me, especially the first meeting too. And also after going after Jeff Bezos from Amazon the way he does, that's another Nixonian move. That's a dictatorial move, and they've got to be stopped because this is going to be constitutional. We're getting closer to a constitutional crisis.
We should say that apparently President Trump, and it's been reported by several outlets, went to the Postmaster General and suggested that he raise the rates on Amazon.
Exactly.
Because Bezos owns the Washington Post.
They were losing money, by the way. That's not true.
I got to say.
That Amazon has been good for the post office, so that's another manipulation. By the way, the person's name I was trying to think of was George Nader, obviously. And George Nader is cooperating with Mueller at this time.
Is he really? I read a column today that said that Nader is a pedophile, too, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
All right, Danny, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. And Juan Cole is the source for that statement I just made. So if you look at Juan Cole's column today, that's what he says. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your message on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Tomorrow, we're going to look at Trump and Russia.